I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining us for the ongoing quest for the awe and the wonder that await each of us every day and all around. Awe can be found in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, in spiritual encounters that move us beyond words. For Mary Colwell, it was a long but deeply meaningful walk. 6 weeks, 500 miles, give or take a few, one footstep at a time, all the way from Enniskillen in Northern Ireland to England's North Sea mudflats. A quick geographic comparison might help here. England and Scotland together stretch for about 600 miles, top to bottom, as the crow flies, from John O'Groats to Land's End. But Mary's walk across the UK didn't follow that north-south axis. Her journey went west to east, moving toward the sunrise with the sun setting at her back.
I literally got a map out of Ireland and the UK sitting next to each other, and I drew a line from the west of Ireland through to the east coast of England. I knew there were one or two places I wanted to go on the way, so it was a bit wiggly at times, but that was as sophisticated as it got. And that just happens to be about 500 miles, which to us in the UK seems like it's a huge way, but it's probably as far as you go to get the daily groceries or something in America, because you have a different concept of of miles than we do.
Anyone might set out on foot for a long adventure for any number of reasons. Health and well-being, tourism, exploration, pilgrimage. Mary Colwell has actually completed other extensive walking tours on both sides of the Atlantic. But in 2016, she took up this particular 500-mile adventure for the curlews. Now, don't feel bad or embarrassed if you don't know exactly what a curlew is. It's not your everyday bird. Mary has become a world-renowned advocate for the species, and her walk traversed dozens of curlew sites in the British Isles, places where curlews feed and breed, migrate and rest, which is to say wherever they're found conducting their lives, persevering against the mounting odds of disappearing as a species. Mary's curlew walk was part personal adventure, part fact-finding mission, part meditative pilgrimage, and part public awareness campaign for these stunning creatures. What would you walk 500 miles for?
To walk across Ireland, Wales, and England at the time was massive to me, and particularly on a route which was not marked on a map as a sort of known walking route. It was make it up basically as you go along, pretty much. But I was driven by the birds.
Mary is founder and director of the charity Curlew Action and chair of the Curlew Recovery Partnership England. There's so much to learn from her about these singular creatures, from their behavior and habitats to their movements as a migratory species, and, of course, the problem of their dwindling numbers. Mary works tirelessly against losing them altogether. There are at least 7, possibly 8, species of curlew remaining. The Eurasian curlew has a broad range, overlapping extensively with human-altered environments. Very few places can really be called wilderness or wild anymore. So in this episode, we're talking about wildlife with an ancient past. Many do say that birds are living dinosaurs. Now barely able to make a go of things in regions that once were wild, but generally no longer are. Mary Colwell's passion for helping these animals and her sheer delight in observing them have infected me with a similar excitement, even though, to my knowledge, I've never set foot anywhere near a curlew. As is so often the case here on Constant Wonder, I'd like you to get a glimpse of even more than the obvious main story, which is her curlew walk and her conservation efforts. You'll also enjoy learning about what it was that first kindled her interest in nature, the connection she sees between nature and the holy or the divine, and, of course, how these curlews came to be a special focus for her. You didn't always care about this migratory bird called the curlew that in some places makes its way all the way, I think, from eastern Poland down to Portugal. that's kind of a pilgrimage too for the bird to make. And when it comes to the UK, you're talking about birds going back and forth between Scandinavia and Ireland. You didn't always care about this. There was a time in your early life when you weren't really connected with nature at all. What were you interested in? What were your passions and your ambitions?
I suppose when I was younger, my passions were like lots of girls, I suppose. I loved ballet. I was really bad at it, but I loved it. I loved my friends and pop songs. And I was fortunate to grow up on the outskirts of a city called Stoke-on-Trent. At that stage, there was still quite a lot of wildlife around in the suburban gardens, and we had a big garden. So I do remember finding frogs in the garden and lots of butterflies on the buddleia bushes and the dawn chorus in May. So I was very aware of it. And my dad was a wonderful man, and he loved the natural world. He wasn't a naturalist in a way that we define maybe now, but he appreciated it and he noticed it and he loved being in it. And I think that was the extent I had to begin with. So at first it was there and I liked being in it, but I didn't think much about it, to be honest. And it was only later, an ex-boyfriend of mine who was studying birds started to explain to me about this fabulous bird called the malachite, the scarlet-tufted malachite sunbird. What a great name is that? And that lived on the slopes of Mount Kenya, and it was a hummingbird, and it lived in very cold conditions. And it was called scarlet-tufted because when it opened its wings out, it had these bright red patches under its wings, and it was a beautiful green colour. And when he explained to me why it did what it did and where it lived, and then started to talk more about the extraordinary behaviour of animals, particularly birds in his case, it was like suddenly someone had just opened a book, and it was the most wondrous picture book you could imagine. And the world, which I loved, came alive. I wouldn't say I didn't love it before. I was very interested in rocks, particularly geology. I did a degree in geology. I love rocks. I think they're fabulous storybooks. But then the things that live all around the rocks suddenly took on a new meaning as well. So then the whole damn thing was extraordinary to me. Things that moved and things that didn't. It was revelatory.
So this scarlet-tufted thingamajig down in Kenya, you had that change, a book opened for you, the world kind of shifted for you without having gone to Kenya? Do I understand that? Was this just on the basis of your ex-boyfriend's narratives of describing the bird?
Yeah, it was. It was just on that. He obviously had photos of them. And so I know I never saw them. I would have loved to have done, but I never went up that high up Mount Kenya to see them. And so it was just the stories. I love listening to people's stories in poetry and literature and music, however they want to describe their story. These were scientific stories. There was just another way of telling stories. Because stories, I think of Brené Brown, the psychologist, she said stories are a data with a soul. And I like that expression. I think we embellish and bring alive facts by the stories we tell about them. And everything he said about the behavior of birds struck me as being the most wondrous stories.
There is a term that I have heard that birders use, and I might get this wrong. I think they talk about a spark bird. Whatever the adjective is, I don't know. But the idea is that it's the first bird that a birder comes across that really seizes their fascination, their imagination. This is the first spark bird story I've ever heard where you were sparked but never saw the bird.
I think that's true. And then I did have my spark bird encounter. I did with when suddenly that wonder took on feathers, you know. And that
and what bird was that?
That was the curlew.
it was the curlew, actually.
It was the curlew.
When and where? When and where the first encounter?
Okay, so right up in Scotland, right up in the north of Scotland. If you imagine a map of England and Scotland, right up in the northeast. And I was waiting for a ferry to go over to the island, the Orkney Islands, which are off the north coast of Scotland. And I was just hanging around waiting. And in a field, there were a flock of curlews. I know now they would have been gathering before going on migration to their wintering grounds. They do it in stages. They'd finish breeding. They gather in these fields and feed up before they fly long distances to wherever they're going to spend the winter. And I must have just come across these birds in a field, and I was mesmerized. It's too tame a word. They were beautiful. They were long-billed, long-necked. They looked funny and elegant at the same time. They looked gawky and sophisticated. They were utterly otherly. They seemed to be creatures from another planet, because most birds, I think, were little and fed on your bird feeders in the garden. These were large and extraordinary looking, and I couldn't take my eyes off them. I still remember just staring at them, thinking, what is this? And then discovering all about them. And when I went over to Orkney, hearing them calling in the fields, and the call of the Eurasian curlew is not dissimilar to the call of the beautiful curlew you have in the States, the long-billed curlew. But I would say we do. You have a longer bill than us. We have a more beautiful call than you. So should we call that one quits? So the Eurasian curlew has this lyrical, bubbling song. Absolutely stupendous. Very yearning, very full of pathos. It's slightly smaller than your curlew and the bill is shorter, but it's just fabulous. And that was it. That was me done.
In my experience with shorebirds, the kind that are waders, and with long legs, often the long bill, this whole family of them, from sandpipers to godwits to whimbrels, that sort of thing, my experience with them is that I can hardly judge their size from a distance, because they might look small standing in the water, and then suddenly they take wing, and then they just seem to just grow in stature. Help us out with the actual size of this thing. How long are the legs? And is it smaller than a watermelon? And watermelon's wrong, because watermelons are plump and round, and these are elegant and sleek.
Well, they're kind of plump and round as well. So if you imagine a mallard duck, okay, we all know a duck, right? Quite a sort of your average duck. And then stick a long pair of legs on it. I don't know. You can't see because this is a podcast, isn't it? enough to get you clear of the water as you're wading around in the shallows, okay? And then you stretch out the neck, get your duck and stretch out its neck. And then it's got a little round head, and then stretch out its bill into this long arcuate form. So it's like a mallard duck with all the extremities extended out. And it's brown and grey, and with some white on it. So it's not exactly colourful at all. But, you know, one of the great benefits of being English is that, as G.K. Chesterton said, to be English is to appreciate the colour grey. And I think those subtle sort of wintry colours, very much like I'm looking out of the window today, can on a bird in winter light look utterly gorgeous, actually, yeah.
The mystery of the bill. When I see an ibis or any bird with this decurved long bill, it doesn't come straight out like a needle, but it bends gracefully downward. I just remember as a child thinking, that is not only impractical, it can't possibly help you get your food. Talk to us a little bit about the behavior relative to the bill. That's for poking around in the water in the muck, I guess.
It is, absolutely. So you mentioned an ibis. The curlew's bill is much thinner than an ibis's bill. So it's not very thick at all, and it's quite scythe-like as it comes out. It is the most amazing instrument. At the end, the end opens independently from the rest of it. So you imagine the very end of the bill has got like a little pair of tweezers on it, if you like. So it's called rhinokinesis, and you can open and close the bill at the end. And it's full of nerve endings. And you put this bill down into the soft mud, and you can feel around for all sorts of creatures down there, sort of shellfish and little worms and all sorts of things that live in the mud, and you can pull them out. So you need a sensitive bill that can go deep into mud. So it allows you to go down. And the round shape allows you to sort of swirl around. If you've got a very straight bill, you're a bit restricted in the the sort of the extent in which your bill can swoop about under the ground and go into burrows. But if you've got a curvy bill, you're much more. So you'll see a curlew feeding and it's got its bill in water or in mud or in soil, and it's constantly twisting its head around as it's trying to feel for burrows and things under the hidden away. So it's a very sensitive, beautiful instrument that allows it to go to places other birds can't reach. The males use it for a bit of play, you know, dramatic display with each other in the breeding season, but it's a beautiful feeding tool.
In a thought piece she wrote 7 years after traversing the UK at its waistline, Mary Colwell reflected back on her venturesome 500-mile foot journey undertaken in honor of Europe's largest wading bird. She described the whole package as a pilgrimage, and she clearly does not use that word as a toss-off, a mere figure of speech. Pilgrimage, she observed, is a word often used loosely, fading in meaning when describing something far more superficial. For me, it is a sacred word that has power. Now, to give you a good sense for her devotion, not just a sense of her drive, her moxie, I really need to mention that the curlew walk we're focusing on here has not been her only literal pilgrimage. She has walked the famous Camino de Santiago, also 500 miles, that goes from France all the way across the northern reaches of Spain, a feat she pulled off during the COVID pandemic. And then she has hiked 230 miles along the John Muir Trail in the Sierra Nevada of California. She happens to be author of the only British biography of that famed naturalist. And then let's mention one more, well over 330 miles through Italy on the Way of St. Francis, from Florence to Rome by way of Assisi, this last journey she made together with her husband. As a devout Catholic, Mary Colwell is fully conversant with the centuries-old image perpetuated of the pious religious wayfarer. But she also bears a deep sympathy with a more modern and often secular impulse of physically traveling as a pilgrim for other reasons. Here's how she has articulated what may be motivating thousands of pilgrims today. "The growth of pilgrimage of all kinds in recent years," she writes, "is testament to the desire to re-enchant a world dulled by human misuses and excesses." Mary's own curlew walk quite clearly was inspired by the tragic circumstances of this species' decline toward extinction and her aim to help rescue them. This ambitious walk of hers should be remembered as a heartfelt effort to re-enchant not only her own private experience of the natural world, but as a gift to the rest of us who benefit from her story, and not least of all, a gift to the curlews.
I was driven by the life cycle of the birds. I wanted to go where they spend the winter on the coast, then move through where they go inland to breed and walk through the inland areas and end up back again at the coast. So in a way, it was a walk through their life as well as a walk across the landscapes, as well as a personal pilgrimage for me.
Were you mostly on streets, on paths, going through fields, in bogs? What terrain were you crossing?
All of that. I took local advice. I didn't always know exactly the route I was going to follow the next day. I knew where I wanted to get to, and I knew the easiest way to get to, which was usually along roads. But I didn't want to walk just along roads. So a lot of the local people said, there's a shortcut down there, or, you know, follow that footpath there. Ireland actually is not that easy for footpaths. That's still got quite a lot of private land you're not allowed to cross. But once you get into England and Wales, then we have a whole threaded network of footpaths that are public access. And you don't actually have to go down many roads. You do some, but not that many. So I try to stay off the roads as much as possible, but not totally. The whole idea of this particular walk was not to escape into the wilderness. That wasn't the idea. The idea was to go and talk to people who understood the wildlife I was interested in. So I wanted to meet people. I wanted to meet scientists and conservationists and farmers and bird watchers and members of the public and artists and poets, you name it. I wanted to meet people. So it was a bit of a curate's egg, if you know that expression.
I don't, actually.
Okay. It's a very strange, it's probably very English. It's a young vicar who was talking to an older vicar and he was trying to impress him. He was just starting out in his career. And the older bishop, I think he was a bishop, said to him, "And how are you finding your breakfast egg this morning?" And actually it was cooked really badly, but he didn't want to say it's a really horrible boiled egg. So he said, "Oh, you know, bishop, it's good in parts." So trying to find trying to find the good in everything, even though it was pretty inedible. So it was a bit of a curate's egg of walk. Some bits were not so pretty. Some bits were spectacular. Some bits were quite dangerous because it was along main roads, but they were few and far between.
I love to walk, and I love to walk with people, but I also love to walk alone. In spite of the fact that you were wanting to have that time face-to-face with people, did you also have some solitude along the way?
Oh, yeah, very much so. And in fact, probably not enough. Like you, I love time on my own walking. There's something about the synergy of the pace of walking, the fresh air, your heartbeat, the way our minds work. Something about that all meshes together, doesn't it? And particularly if you give yourself time, and it needs time, good things need time, and the time just grew. And it was a bit like when I walked the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela, very much like the John Muir Trail, which I walked in the Yosemite. Those are long-distance solitary trails. The Curlew Walk wasn't quite like that, but it had elements of that. So there were times of just long walks along mountain tracks or across fields where I was entirely on my own. And I remember those probably more clearly than many of the other times. I remember walking through a great big fields in the centre of England, just getting into the farmland where the fields get much bigger and there are a lot more crops. So you've left the little fields with little stony walls and little hedges around them, and you've got into the bigger landscapes in the centre and towards the east of England. And I just remember walking across those, nothing and nobody around, nothing at all, and singing along to pop songs at the top of my voice. I mean, I never sing in public, but you know, Adele, she really has competition with me. I was fantastic.
Well, Mary, I enjoy a little improv now and then, and I'm going to try some improv with you. You've mentioned three pilgrimages: Santiago de Compostela, the John Muir Trail, and this 500-mile Curlew Walk. Could you possibly take three discrete, specific places, one from each of those trails, where there was some connection of any kind, of similarity, a moment, a place, where what you felt and saw and experienced and encountered might be a bridge between these three different pilgrimages?
I think the bridge has to be not so much what the landscape looks like. Obviously, those are three very, very different places to walk. It has to be the bridge where you suddenly felt as though the veil between yourself and something much bigger was quite thin. Those are the times, I think, that just sparkle and come alive. And they come unexpectedly, and they come usually with an encounter of some kind, a sudden vista or something that strikes you that you weren't expecting to see. And I think on the John Muir Trail, early one morning, very, very cold, I woke up and I just went down to the river to have a drink and to sort of brush my teeth and looked up, and there was a black bear just on the other side. And, you know, that's amazing to somebody from a country where our biggest animal is a badger, you know. I couldn't believe how huge it was and how magnificent. And I remember my hands were feeling so cold because of the cold water, and it was early in the morning. And all I wanted to do was walk over to it and put my hands in its fur, which would have been not a great plan, but that's what it made me feel. And just that connection with a wild creature on my own in the middle of a vast landscape was magical. It was utterly, utterly magical. In the Curlew Walk, I was walking on not a very interesting road. It was quite high and it was going over a sort of hill between two villages. It was getting towards the evening and it was a lovely evening, quite warm, quite sultry. And I was just walking along this track, not thinking about anything in particular. It was quite a built-up area. And a curlew just suddenly flew across the road. I wasn't expecting to see one. I didn't even know they were there. But the fact that it sang so beautifully and so clearly in the evening air, and there were houses not very far away, in a place I wasn't expecting, suddenly made me think the world is definitely full of magic. It definitely is. There are wondrous things if you open yourself out to the time to experience them. And then on the Santiago de Compostela, there were so many of those, to be honest, but because that was very solitary. Of all the three, that was the most solitary because I walked it in between lockdowns in the COVID time when everybody was basically inside. It was legal. It wasn't a lockdown time, but it was in between lockdowns. People were a bit fearful of going out. And I chose to walk across northern Spain at that time. So there was almost no one around. And I had hours and hours and hours of never meeting anybody. And I think the most beautiful time was when I went up to this place called the Cruz de Ferro, which is the Iron Cross. I set off very early in the morning and it's a huge mound at the top of a hill, quite a high point in the whole pilgrimage trail. And it's been going for, you know, 1,000 years. And people take their stones. You can take one from home, or you can carry little things from home, or you can just find a stone on the track. And you approach this mound, which is huge, with a big cross that's in the center of it. And people just put their stones on this mound. So it gets bigger and bigger and bigger all the time. And in the quiet of the early morning, with no one around, the distant vista of mountains, it's by a road, but there was no traffic. And that early morning peace with a mound of dreams of people left in stones was just beautiful. And I think when I think of Santiago de Compostela, I don't think of the cathedral. I don't think of all the other things that everyone associates with, all the albergues and the crowds. I had none of that. But I had those quiet moments to myself, knowing that I was one of just thousands upon thousands of people who'd set out on a pilgrimage with all their individual yearnings and longings. And I was just a part of it at that point. And I felt very close to everybody else that had walked that trail.
These three instances that you've shared with us, is it too presumptuous of me to say this, that they changed you?
Oh, beyond doubt. I mean, of course. Those three big, deliberate times that I took on my own to go and do something that meant something to me, there's too much endeavor, there's too much uncertainty, there's too much aloneness, there's too much vulnerability, there's too much awe and wonder, which is the lovely concept of your podcast. There's too much of all of that concentrated down into a few weeks and pump primed into your life. How could it not change you?
Mary Colwell is our guest in this episode of Constant Wonder. Some people go far in life, many on foot. That description fits Mary, who has always been an avid walker. But the figurative sense of having had a great career, well, that fits her too. She's been a producer for the BBC Natural History Unit, has published multiple beloved books about her experiences and her hard-earned understandings of nature, and she is founder and director of the organization Curlew Action,
dedicated to the conservation of curlews globally, and she's also chair of the Curlew Recovery Partnership England, which is dedicated to reversing the decline of the Eurasian curlew. There is a beauty in an animal just from its appearance, but also in its behavior. You have mentioned its song, which is just elegant. I'm just wondering, in terms of all this, all these avenues to beauty in a bird, there is something about just the migration, which is so stunning. And we've got to talk about the vulnerability of migratory birds, this bird species in particular, and its decline in numbers, because that factors into your attention to it as well as all of the marvel of just the creature itself. The fact that it's imperiled.
Oh, it's hugely imperiled. And that's the heartbreak of the whole story, isn't it? That this world is full of these wondrous creatures that they don't see our boundaries. They don't see our political maneuverings. They just see a planet and they need to go from one place to the other to complete their life cycle. So in the case of the Eurasian curlew, it needs to go from Scandinavia or the northern part of Europe where it breeds. A lot of the European curlews breed in the sort of more northerly part. And then come the winter, it gets too cold for them there. So they come south and often west and end up on the British shores. Our curlews in the UK and Ireland breed inland in the higher ground and they move out to the coasts in the winter. They move to complete their life cycles. They're travellers. They beat to a different rhythm to us. They have a different sense of the world than we do. They're guided by stars and by wind and by weather, by the seas, by the shape of the land, by the contours of things. You know, their world is different to ours. And all along the way, that's hard enough being a migratory bird without having all the things that we put in the way, whether that's shooting, whether that's building over their feeding areas, whether that's polluting their water, whether that's setting fire to things, whether whatever it is that we do. And we do a lot of things that affect them, whether that's building wind turbines at times as well in the wrong places, whatever. You know, it's just more impediment to a bird that finds it hard to survive. So they're supremely adapted. They're supremely fitted to live on this planet. But if you put too many impediments in something's way, it just can't overcome it. You know, they're not infinitely adaptable. And they have a physicality suited to a particular way of living. And that particular way of living is altered by the way we farm, by our leisure, by our need for resources and buildings and development. And all of it just chips away. And slowly but surely, they disappear. And the big problem with the Eurasian curlew is it just can't get enough chicks to fledge. So the decline is coming from the breeding season. They lay 4 eggs a year. They only need to fledge 1 chick every other year to keep their population stable, and they can't even do that. They're not even producing, in many populations, 1 chick every 4 years. So the breeding success, as it's called, of the Eurasian curlew is probably less than half of what it should be.
Is any of this related to natural predation, foxes or what have you?
Yes, there's a huge amount of predation on them. And of course, they're very used to being predated. You know, if you're only producing 1 fledged chick every other year to keep a healthy population, that means you're losing most of them to predators pretty much all the time. In the UK, everything is farmed or built on. We're quite a crowded country, as you know. And the way that we've intensified the land use has meant that generalist predators like foxes and crows do really, really well here, and badgers. And we have eradicated some of the bigger predators that would have kept those under control, like eagles and wolves and bears or whatever. So there's a big imbalance in the system. There's lots of food available in our towns and cities and in the farmed landscape to keep foxes breeding very successfully. the way the climate is changing and warming has meant that there's not a big die-off in the winter either. It's much warmer in the winters than it used to be. So there are a lot of middle-sized predators, mesopredators as they're called, and they take a huge toll on ground nesting birds.
Well, Mary, let's go back to your walking 500 miles to meet people and to talk up curlews with them. One could imagine this any number of ways. One of my fantasies here would be that you're wearing a sandwich board that says, save the curlews, and you're just introducing people to the problem who've never heard that there is a problem. I would imagine you did meet such people. But what did you encounter in terms of any existing affection for the birds, people who already knew of them, they were part of their life, they would see them come and go, that they cherished them? Did you meet that crowd as well?
Yeah, and undoubtedly I did. And I met certainly the people who still love them, who are still very aware of them, who are still working hard to save them. So I definitely met the conservation side of people, the people who just thought, oh, thank goodness somebody is doing something for curlews because we're noticing them disappearing. And I also met, though, the people who had forgotten they loved them, that they did love them, but they'd slipped away and they hadn't realized that that sound and that presence in their landscapes was no longer there. I found that particularly in Ireland. And one very moving encounter was with an old man. I was tired. I was walking through the center of Ireland. I was feeling a bit tired and I just plonked myself down on a bench in the middle of a city, in the middle of a town. I'd gone to get a sandwich and a coffee or something. And I just sat there and this old man was sitting there. And I started talking to him and he had moved away from the countryside and into the town to be near his family. And I told him that I was working for the curlew and he said, the curlew, of course. He said, gosh, a long time since I've seen a curlew. And I said, do you remember what they sound like? And I had my iPad out and I had the recording on it and I pressed it and the call came out of the iPad. And he immediately burst into tears. And tears literally streamed down his face. And he was looking way beyond the shop fronts and the people walking past. And he had gone somewhere in the past to his childhood. And he said, I remember them. They were all in the fields when I grew up. And I remember that sound. And then eventually said, turn it off. Please, please turn it off. I can't bear the memories. And it was so moving to hear that. And I heard that a lot. Oh, that's the curlew. My goodness, I'd forgotten about that. Where are they?
I have always been a great admirer of St. Francis of Assisi. And I know you have been too. When I think of St. Francis, I think of the famed stories of him, the sermon to the birds, to actually see them as fellow creatures, as fellow beings, rather than any sort of subordinate way. And people today in science would all the time say things, well, we can't anthropomorphize these animals. You know, we don't want to impose like existences upon them that don't belong to them, that we're just imagining for them and making them like us. Having said all of that, introduce us to your particular interest in St. Francis.
Well, it has to come, doesn't it, from all the stories we get told as children. And he was like a sort of holy Dr. Doolittle to me. I mean, he could talk to animals. I mean, wow, you know. And that idea of talking to the birds or going into the forest to a mad wolf and just talking to it and it sitting down and listening to him, to me, I wanted to be sitting at that man's feet. I wanted him to lead me. I really wanted to see what he saw in the natural world. I wanted to know what it was in his heart that made him call a fish his brother, that made him call a cicada his sister, you know. That was revolutionary. You imagine, it's pretty wacky now, what it was like in the 13th century to hear someone say that. He was an absolute radical, but never straying outside the sort of understanding of Christianity at the time, and we still have. He didn't stray from that, but he enriched it hugely by drawing in everything else and saying, it's not just about us. It's about all this wondrous stuff that God has put on earth, that we can encounter and live with and learn from and be tested by and find joy in. You know, it was just revolutionary. And I couldn't get enough of his stories of nature, so much so that myself and my husband went and walked the St. Francis Way, which is another pilgrimage route. And we did it in two-week pilgrimages. And to walk through the mountains he walked through, to sort of through the vineyards, through the forest groves, over the bare mountains, you know, to sort of go to those ancient villages. I suddenly felt I knew him a lot better. And then to go to the place where he actually was supposed to have talked to the wolf, a place called Gubbio, now built up and it's quite big and busy and the forest has all gone and it's now a housing estate. But there's a little church right next to where it is said that he met the wolf, and it's by a roundabout in the middle of a housing estate. But you can still go and sit in that church, and St. Francis will come and sit with you, you know, and you can screen out the trees and the houses, and you can be back in that forest, and you feel something of the connectedness that he must have felt, that sense of that God was literally everywhere, everywhere.
When I think of St. Francis speaking with his fellow brothers and sisters, the creatures, the animals, the birds, I think of the times when I have been out and about and I've seen a fox or a squirrel even, maybe a common robin. But in my own way, I haven't talked to them to have them talk back to me, but I tend to address God. And I'm wondering if in your experience on this pilgrimage, the St. Francis pilgrimage, or any of the three previous ones that you've mentioned, in encountering an animal, does that kind of launch you into some relationship with God?
Sure. I mean, sure. Faith is a very important part of who I am. And I try to see the world as a spiritual being, not just as a conservationist or a writer or running a charity and all the other things. I try to see the world as a sort of soul as well. And those encounters with the natural world are encounters with God without a shadow of a doubt. And that doesn't have to be on a pilgrimage route in the middle of Spain or in the middle of Italy or even the Yosemite. It can be in my garden when I watch bees on the flowers or I hear the robin. You know, they are just as spiritual to me. And that's why I love John Muir so much as well. Because his utter wonder, daily wonder at God in the world. St. Francis and John Muir share the same sense that, you know, preach every day and sometimes use words, you know. And I think that's very much what I'd like to do. I don't have to be a preacher. I'm not a preacher. But boy, do I understand the presence of God in the natural world.
So I was reading about John Muir. I think he was headed towards South America and never quite made it all the way there, if I remember. You will know this, but having written a biography about him. But he was walking. He got to a place in Tennessee, and he just talked it up so floridly in his language. I thought this couldn't have been the temple he called it to have been, but he was convinced it was the most beautiful place he'd ever been in his life. What do you make of John Muir's language when he was exuding the sense of worship in nature? Was it all for effect? Did he really believe it? Did he stand behind that?
Oh, gosh, he really believed it. But he was on a mission to change the heart of America. He was on a mission to bring this deep sense of love that he had in his heart to the America, which he saw was just ravaging the earth, if you see. I mean, he saw the destruction of the big forests. He saw the end of the passenger pigeon. He saw the end of the buffaloes on the plains. You know, he saw the rivers stripped of fish. He saw the mad mining that was going on. He saw it all. He saw the industrialization of America at its worst, probably. So he was on a mission to use the talent that he'd got, which was with words, to say, no, no, listen, stop, read, think, you know, be moved by this. A lot of his language was almost a desperate cry to stop and look and listen. And so I understand that. But I do think he felt it very keenly as well. He said he saw poems. He said everything's a little poem of wildness. You just have to look and see the verses and let them speak to you. They can be the great sagas of a landscape. They can be the haiku of a street flower. It doesn't matter. He felt it. Absolutely, he felt it. And if I can see that beauty reflected in a weed or in a bird or in a slug, you know, on my lettuces, I will be determined to find it.
Something about reading John Muir that I've noticed, maybe I'm just talking about representative excerpts, quotations, people lift those from him all the time. Well, it's that if you get swept off your feet by his rather extravagant, flowery descriptions of nature, you know, the man could really gush when he wanted to. You can easily just forget how routinely he actually put himself in harm's way. He stuck out his neck. He was in truly dangerous wilderness situations. So, Mary, you're just the right person to address a very important issue. Not just, by the way, because you're a John Muir biographer, but because you're also author of a volume that's titled Beak, Tooth, and Claw, Why We Must Live with Predators. It is totally justifiable for us to sometimes think that with nature's dangers, its violence even, it's hard to praise nature sometimes. Here's where I'm going with this. Foxes kill curlews, after all. And so you just have to ask yourself, is God, is beauty, is wonder right there in this violence of creature eating creature?
Yeah, sure. Of course. I mean, things eat to live. We all eat to live. We call it violence, which is a very anthropomorphic way of looking at it. It's just a cycle of life for the creatures that do it. So, of course. And I think that's a danger. If we just have pretty sunsets and lovely flowers to look at and say, we have a holy world, look at all this beauty, then you really do have a bit of a problem when it comes to stinging bees and alligators that will bite your leg off, because that's not really beautiful, is it, in that sense? It's something very different. And I think it forces us to share the planet with wildness. Wildness is part of the whole system, and we have to accept that. The harshness of the natural world teaches us to be vulnerable, teaches us to be humble, teaches me anyway. This isn't actually all about me. It isn't all about you. It isn't all about the human species. It's about all of us surviving on a planet which is utterly, utterly wondrous. And that comes in all shades and with all aspects. Who said it was going to be easy? Who said everything's lovely and easy? It isn't. Life isn't lovely and easy. Seeing the way the natural world operates, the predation, the prey, that the way the cycles of life can be utterly brutal and cold and, in our words, you know, violent, that's all part of it. And that's part of accepting a mystery which is beyond my understanding, but I'm very, very willing to accept it.
Have you ever in your work dealing with curlews been so close to the phenomenon of predation that you have either seen a bird seized by a fox or a crow, or seen the aftermath up close and personal to that aspect of nature?
Yeah, sure. And you can't work on curlews and not be close to it. If you get taken out to see nests, I've been out with the people working very closely with them, and they say, oh, there's a curlew nest over there. We'll creep up on it. The bird will fly away for a bit, but it will come back. Don't worry. And we just go up to see. And there is no adult bird there. There's just destroyed eggs in the nest with a few little blooded bodies. Obviously, an attack. And that's heartbreaking because you know that every egg is precious. Every bird is precious. And you know that the fox is out there somewhere. And you want it to stop. You do. You want to do anything to stop. But, you know, it's all above my pay grade in a way. All I can do is let the people who are there doing the work on the ground work out the best way to protect those creatures. But I can tell their story. That's my job. I can't do everybody's job. I can only do my job. And mine is to tell their story, bring the wonder back, connect people as much as I can to the natural world, and just give this message. We can all tell their stories and we can all work together to make a world much, much better than it is at the moment.
Earlier, you described the call, the song of the curlew, as sounding full of pathos and yearning. Emotion is, of course, not something that we can ever confidently say that a curlew is experiencing when it's vocalizing. That's us projecting our human experience onto another species. We do that all the time. But still, I can't keep from asking you, must the curlew song in the end be a mournful song, or can we hear some hope for their future in those notes?
If you let yourself think it will be mournful, if I let myself think I was going to lose this battle, I'm not sure where I'd go. I have to believe that the curlew song is a joyful one, that it has pathos in it, that it has a memory of toughness and loss and grief, but it also has threaded through it the sort of rising tones of hope as well. I have to believe that. Being defeatist is not an option. That's not what we're called to be. We're not called to be negative, cynical, or naysayers. I think that I'm here to be the opposite. And I think I'm here to find the good, to celebrate the good, and to find more good, however hard that is, and however increasingly hard it is to find at times. If we lost the curlew, nobody would die, nobody would lose their jobs, no one would get ill, the world would carry on, but it would be without a unique creature. If I look around the farmland of the UK and there are curlews there, I know that's what good looks like. I know that there are insects on the flowers, the soft and damp soils, the space, the right conditions in which they can breed, and there's the right areas in which they can spend the winter. So they indicate to me that the world is okay, you know, that we're doing something right. So they could disappear, and I doubt, and as is the case in many areas where they have disappeared, the world doesn't come to an end, but it's lesser. It's a lesser place because of that. So I'm never going to give in to it'll be a mournful song. I will never give in to that. And until the last curlew sings, I'll be singing with them.
Getting to know Mary Colwell has been a privilege and an honor. She is director of Curlew Action, which you ought to check out sometime online. She's a writer, a producer in TV and radio, and an influential conservationist. Her 500-mile walk across the breadth of the UK in 2016 helped elevate the plight of curlews, helped to elevate their profiles so that the public can care more about them. Her writings include the books Curlew Moon, John Muir, the Scotsman Who Saved America's Wild Places, Beak, Tooth, and Claw, and The Gathering Place, A Winter Pilgrimage Through Changing Times. This episode of Constant Wonder was produced by me, Marcus Smith, with assistance from Tenery Taylor and Elaine Scott. Thanks for listening. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.